Hello from Brooklyn. I'm Brendan Hart, and welcome to Super Cities, a no BS deep dive conversation about the people and trends moving cities forward. All views expressed are my own and do not reflect our sponsors or partners. Let's get into it. On this episode of Super Cities, we do a deep dive on cryptocurrency, blockchain, and the next generation of digital technologies with Peter Shanley, head of business development for BRD. For 15 years, Peter has brought innovative products and services to market for Fortune 500s, startups, and nonprofits. And now he works all things crypto. Let's hear from Peter. Glad to have Peter Shanley, head of business development for BRD, with us today. Peter, thanks for joining us.
It's nice to be here on a rainy day in New York.
Rainy, but steamy. I thought we'd be into fall weather. We're not. It's 85 degrees out. How do you describe to your buddies or former associates in San Francisco the sort of distinct features of the New York City ecosystem?
It's interesting, right? New York has a deep history of philanthropy and also a deep history of cutthroat capitalism, right? And so there's sometimes a tension here. The tension is represented every day, right? This past summer was the first time our family was settled enough to leave New York. And it was amazing to leave. And it throws this interesting catch-22 in your face where you're saying, I invest so much of my time, my treasure, myself, and why do I feel so good when I leave, right? And so for me, you know, there's a truism, right? Technology changes, people don't. My background is in social psychology and economics, right? And I had a, you know, double major in psychology and economics. Soon thereafter, the phrase behavioral economics was in vogue, which struck me as a bit straightforward. I said, I've never met a rational man. And so homo economicus, which money theories are based on, for me just isn't realistic, right? People are passionate, people are tribal. And that really is what got me into blockchain, right? Is how do we actually take this technology and apply it in a better pursuit of capitalism, right? And so for me, what I love about blockchain is it relies on a social psychology truism, which is that you cannot trust individuals, but you can trust communities of a certain size and affiliation, right? Whether it's a geographic affiliation, a specific, you know, civic organization, a specific industry, right? When you get a sample size large enough, you can trust the wisdom of the crowds, right? And that's what a lot of the blockchain technology comes down to, is that more than half of the people in a marketplace or an ecosystem or a platform cannot be bad actors in the same way. When you start to tip that point over 50%, the bad actor groups splinter off into smaller groups, right? And so whether it's, you know, proof of work or proof of stake, what I love about this technology is it comes back to social psychology.
Interesting. So let's hop into BRD here. BRD is a simple and secure on-ramp to Bitcoin, Ethereum, and other digital currencies. Just zoom out for me here. What problem is BRD solving?
What BRD is trying to do is empower people to take control of their financial freedom, right? And so to be able to transact, to act, to work, to get paid, to make, you know, means and ends meet for your family without having someone in the middle to take a cut. Right. And so what makes BRD unique is that we are non-custodial and decentralized, which means that we never take custody of your identity or your assets. So there's no honeypot to hack. There's no list to hand to government. And we're basically a bridge between your phone and the public chain. Right. And so you are in complete control. And what our engineering team has done is no small feat, which is not cutting corners, remaining non-custodial, which is the most secure, the most private way to do it. But we have a great user experience, right? A lot of people cut corners. They have centralized databases. They get hacked, right? They proactively hand your data to the government if you hold a certain asset, you know, threshold. But we really believe in that individual empowerment. And that's kind of what we do, is we try to make it as, you know, seamless of a user experience as, you know, the other apps on your phone, but remaining non-custodial.
Who are your users and where are your users? Help the listeners understand who would be utilizing BRD's platform.
Yeah. And so just for a little bit of history, you know, BRD used to be called Bread Wallet. Bread Wallet was invented by our co-founder, Aaron Voisin. And he built it for himself, right? Very early in the crypto space and wanted to have a non-custodial wallet and was not happy with the status quo of what was available to him at the time, right? So he built it. We were the first iOS app in crypto. And so our early users were actually old school hodlers, right? People who are, you know, holding crypto assets for a long time, right? And so we provided a free, you know, great app that they used. And so we, you know, over years were able to grow to about, a, you know, 750,000 users in 150 countries. And so we did an ICO to better capitalize the business. We've taken traditional venture money, but we've also layered on top of that a $32 million ICO, right? But we did it with a product in market and real revenue and a real team behind it who've all launched products across the world in the Fortune 500. So the technology is solid, right? And what we've done actually is take that capital, you know, triple the size of the engineering team, and actually build Bread Wallet into a platform. The vision was never just to be a non-custodial wallet for your Bitcoin. It was to be a passport to crypto-backed financial products and services. And so how we do that is actually through partnerships often, right? And so we will act as the retail last mile for exchanges, loan providers, and any, you know, financial service or product that's powered by crypto. We kind of act as a retail last mile and a unified user kind of touch point. Because for a user, they might not care if it's, you know, purchasing Bitcoin or Ethereum or a token from one exchange or another. They want the best price and the fastest liquidity, right? And so we're almost the Switzerland of Swiss Bitcoin companies. We're headquartered in Zug, Switzerland. But we are very, you know, open and neutral, right? We integrate with partners who sometimes offer redundant services, right? And so we're not, you know, picking winners. For us, we want to be an easy on-ramp for mainstream. And we're really transitioning from that very techie kind of early adopter crowd to a much more mainstream crowd. So we've got about 1.4 million users today in 160 plus countries. And in this last year have just added integrations with, you know, Simplex for credit card and debit card purchases, Glidera and Kraken for fiat on-ramps and off-ramps in the US, integrating with Coinify for SEPA, talking to exchanges in Canada, Coinberry, in Australia, you know, Bitcoin Australia. And so what we'll do is actually bring value to our users through B2B partnerships, right? And so we're kind of a B2B2C marketplace where you can think of us more as, you know, a technology provider and a marketing affiliate, bringing liquidity to banks, brokers, and other financial institutions. You know, we're not a bank ourselves. We're just a really easy way for you to access those services. Now, of note there is our non-custodial nature, right? Especially when you're dealing with fiat, you have to be known. You go through KYC, AML, right? And so we are very conservative legally in terms of every partner we work with. We do our diligence to make sure they comply with the regulations in the jurisdictions they operate in, right? I've worked in government. I've worked in nonprofits and public-private partnerships. I very much respect regulation, right? And that is an interesting moment in our industry. You know, 2017 was a bit of a Wild West. San Francisco was actually a good anchor for kind of this ecosystem. And in the last year, we've actually seen security tokens and securities trading law and compliance kind of come into the space. And for us, we're excited by that, right? It might tamp down some of the innovative uses and applications of the technology, but constraints are actually freeing because they focus you, right? You know where the goalposts are now. And so we're seeing this shift from, you know, a utility token, ICO bonanza, you had straight up Ponzi schemes, you know, teams that were well-intentioned, but at the wrong timing, teams that were brilliant, but had never built production code or grown a team to 30 people before, right? And so you're starting to see some of that noise take itself out of the ecosystem, and you're starting to see a lot more traditional players, right? So New York is actually, you know, gaining momentum and as a center of gravity for the ecosystem because of New York's rich history with securities trading.
Talk me through what non-custodial means.
Yep.
What are the advantages of being a non-custodial platform?
Custody means that there is a central database in our servers that contain, you know, your username, password, identity, that actually store your assets, right? That we actually might, you know, take your assets and put it in a central place to hold it, right? And so for us, the power of this technology is really about cutting out the middlemen. And what we're seeing is a lot of people, you know, Coinbase is a great example, right? They're a centralized authority. You are trusting Coinbase and they can be hacked. They can hand your data to the government. We like Coinbase, right? They have a great user experience. And we haven't really sacrificed that non-custodial nature and kind of maintain that our user experience is kind of on par, Right. And so a lot of what we'll do with that is interesting is kind of offer users a hybrid experience where they get the best of both worlds, where they may begin a transaction in our non-custodial wallet, which is more of a portfolio manager, you could think of it. They may, in the flow of acquiring an asset, you know, go into a centralized environment, you know, take pictures of their passport, of their faces with a selfie, go through, you know, accreditation and background checks, right? And as soon as the asset is kind of paid for, or as soon as that person kind of, you know, transacts, the asset returns to the protection of our wallet, which is unhackable.
What's the advantage for a non-BRD entity to create the centralized experience, if what I'm hearing is correct, which is the nature of the value transaction is that you're cutting out the centralized middle person?
So it's interesting, right? And it depends on whether you're exchanging crypto for crypto or fiat for crypto or crypto for fiat, right? When you deal with fiat, you have to be known. You have to engage with a centralized entity. And that's what I was saying. We kind of give this hybrid, you know, offering where from our wallet, which is non-custodial, you know, if you want to engage in a fiat on-ramp or off-ramp, you'll go through KYC AML. If you want to just trade crypto for crypto, you know, we give you the power to do that without, you know, a central bank in any nation blocking you.
Got it. So talk to me about the crypto blockchain ecosystem in New York and in other locations around the world. It seems to me that BRD is sort of intentionally global in nature.
Yep.
You have users all over the place.
Our team is fully decentralized, right? So we've got offices in Tokyo, Zurich, outside of Gibraltar, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Bend, Oregon, Canada, Texas, Philippines, right? And so for us, being kind of distributed around the world is great because we can build relationships both with B2B partners, right, who give us depth in certain geos, as well as with consumers who, you know, may want different things. Now, what's interesting here is that, you know, crypto is really being driven outside of the U.S., right? And so New York is one of the most conservative states in the U.S. And so I know people who are moving startups out of this state, you know, every week, right? And so, you know, having spent some time getting the New York Government Blockchain Association off the ground, it's interesting, right? Jobs talk, right? And so we've had policy makers, right, at the state and the local level here, talking about the fact that we need to be more open to this new wave, right? And so that's where it's exciting with securities law coming into the space, right? If all it does is capture the liquidity gap, right? If many securities today are priced 6 or 7% too low because they're so hard to transact, if all you do is capture that, but you're talking about $1 trillion pension funds, that's a big deal.
Right.
Right. And so we're seeing a lot of interesting real estate plays, right? There's a $30 million residential building in New York that was just tokenized this month. Templum, they just did an Aspen resort, right? And raised $18 million for that. There's a castle in Long Island I know that's getting tokenized. People are tokenizing Picassos, right? And so a lot of those assets that were very hard to move can now be owned by many different people in many fractional ways. And that's an exciting thing.
And give me the quick overview on what the process or the value of tokenizing.
Yeah. So there's a couple of concepts that are core to this, right? One is called a zero knowledge proof and one is called a smart contract. Because a ledger in a blockchain Web3.0 stack is immutable and you can trust it, it allows people to transact with simple yes or no questions. An example that I like to give is this. You know, I've got two young kids, so I don't really go out anymore, but I see kids sometimes, you know, waiting to get into a bar and they swipe their ID. That bar is getting a lot of data about you. Your name, your height, your eye color, whether you're an organ donor, potentially public records associated with you.
And likely does not have a security layer.
Correct.
Right.
And they only need to know one thing, right? Can this person enter this establishment today?
Right.
Right. They don't need to know the age of my wife. They need to know a yes or no question.
Right.
Right. And because the ledger is immutable, you can transact with other entities with simple yes or no questions without having to have a middleman take a cut to make you feel safe.
Right.
Right. The smart contract is really interesting. A smart contract is basically business and legal logic put into code. You can almost think of it like this. It makes digital currency and terms and conditions one and the same thing, right? This is not a dollar bill unless, you know, 20 cents goes to the coffee bean grower. 20 cents goes to offset the carbon shipping it to New York. 20 cents goes to the barista. 20% goes to the rent, right? And so it allows people to transact in a marketplace and kind of predefine the rules of the game, right? And so that is a powerful thing.
Right, right. Right.
And so it allows people to, whether it's, you know, supply chain management, logistics, you know, data brokering and data sovereignty, right? It changes the feasibility on a more cooperative approach to marketplaces, right? Instead of the person who has the best lawyers or the most leverage negotiating terms up front, it allows people to say, hey, here is the value we believe is going to be created. Here's how we're going to reward people who create value. And you can actually trust that the marketplace is going to reward people commensurate to how you planned. Right. And so it's a much more kind of cooperative and open exchange of commerce.
But tell me how that concept is distilled into a real estate transaction that's tokenized.
So, you know, basically, you know, you can take all the, you know, triplicate carbon copy legalese and digitize it. Right. And so that this, you know, real estate, you know, brick and mortar space can be sliced and diced and transacted with a speed and kind of a fractionality that was not feasible before, right? Like Web 3.0 changes everything, right? It's as inevitable as the cloud, right? And we're also seeing how many banks and institutions are still struggling moving to the business cloud.
Right.
Right. So blockchain is in the news. It's hyped. People are looking at Bitcoin, and that's exciting for, you know, public awareness and to kind of, you know, put some capital into the ecosystem. But this is a 30-year journey. Right. And we're just at the start.
Just at the start. And we have not hit the inflection point on the enterprise side.
It's even the Fortune 500 folk like IBM. Right. When they're doing blockchain solutions, it's mostly consulting. Right. They're not deploying enterprise grade platforms. Right. It's still at that phase. And what's interesting to note here, you know, is around, you know, I've seen this before. Right. So I was in San Francisco working from South Park at the birth of Web 2.0, the social web.
Right.
Right. And I saw a lot of idealistic people who were going to connect the world. Right. What are we seeing 20 years later? Right. Culture, society is being shaken by the platforms that were supposed to bring us together. Right. Weapons of mass persuasion. Zeynep Tufekci from UNC Chapel Hill calls it.
Okay.
Right. And so what I don't want to have happen is that same thing. Right. 20 years, 15 years later, to look at the idealism and some of this kind of more cooperative capitalism that we're seeing people talk about now. Right. We need to make sure that the right human leadership is at the table to make sure we use this technology in a more sustainable way. Right. And that's why for me, whether it was Web 2.0 or now, for 15 years, I've basically done diversity and inclusion work in technology. Right. That's getting, you know, more women and underrepresented people in it. It's working with veterans. It's working with disabled people. It's working with public-private partnerships. That's a different type of diversity that we need in this, right? And what I don't want to have happen again is what we saw, right? That these platforms, even with the best intentions, have kind of been co-opted, whether by VC board member push for that 10x or bust exit, right? Or people just exploiting it, right? Because the people who are in power have first mover advantage on new technology. They know about it. They can invest in it. And we're seeing around the world today what happens when the people in power are a little shook that technology is changing and the world looks different, right? And so Whether it's Brexit, Trump, Putin, Adrogen, we're seeing populism rise because people are shook. People are scared. People don't know how their kids are going to make a living, right? This happened 100 years ago when electrification happened, right? There was blood in the streets until World War I around the world when we put people back to work. You know, in New York, when automobiles came in, all the people who worked in the horse industry were breaking windows and slashing tires,
right?
We've seen this before, and hopefully we can do better this time.
I agree.
Sorry to rant.
No. I think it's an important point. If Web 2.0 was a sort of social graph through a bunch of applications, it seems to me that the elements, the founding elements or driving elements of Web 2.0 were largely American. Yeah. American companies, American venture dollars, American regulations.
Where when Web 1.0 started, right? And
right.
So one of the interesting things there is this concept of fat and skinny protocols, right? The protocols of Web 1.0 and the protocols that fueled the social web were skinny protocols, right? Email, you know, GPS, these were thin layers that the government and the academics who launched them didn't quite understand where it would go, right? And so it allowed people to build fat applications on top of skinny protocols and take all the value, right? Uber doesn't reflect the true cost of goods sold when they pick you up in a car because, you know what? The public commons police those streets and pave those roads.
Right.
Right? What you have the potential in Web 3.0 is what they call fat protocols and skinny apps, right? Because of these zero knowledge proofs and these smart contracts, it allows that protocol layer, the supply chain of value delivery, to be broken down much more granularly and people rewarded commensurate to the value they're putting into the system, right? Into the platform, into the marketplace. So that, you know, you can have this, you know, cooperative handoff where a business doesn't have to own the whole stack, right? It's not like Mitsubishi or General Electric, right? It allows people to play smaller puzzle pieces of the marketplace and know their role, right? And that's a powerful thing if we do it right.
So Web 3.0 is this concept of decentralization, of protocol trust in this.
It's a natural extension, honestly. I mean, you know, why DARPA invested in the protocols of Web 1.0 was because of a threat of communist Russia.
Right.
Right. So, you know, they didn't want to have a central node that could get wiped out with a nuclear weapon or a spy, you know, or some virus. Right. And so they wanted to create a constellation of nodes that could share data. So there was no one single point of failure.
Yes.
We're taking that into three dimensions now.
Okay.
Right. That was kind of a, you know, information sharing, not, you know, the actual pipes.
Right.
Right. And so now what we're talking about is there will be, you know, I say today we're kind of in what I call the protocol wars, right? There are protocols that are redundant. There are protocols that showed first mover advantage, like ETH and Ethereum and ERC20 as an ecosystem. You're looking at people like EOS and Stellar who, you know, thank you very much, ETH and Ripple for showing and validating the need for this. We're going to do it faster, better, take you, you know, and just potentially go past you, right? So there's this really interesting thing. And to your point before about ecosystems, because of the kind of social psychology of this potential technology, the ecosystem is critical, right? One of the things that got me into ETH and Ethereum early was seeing hackers and corporates lining up behind it, right? I'd seen this before. When you see Fortune 500s and, you know, Mountain Dew swilling hackers grooving on the same technology, that's a good thing, right? Because we talk about
something there.
Yeah, right. And that's what we call talk about diversity and inclusion, right? You need different stakeholders to come together to solve the really hairy challenges of our time. You know, but we're seeing, you know, a bear market the last 5-6 months.
Right.
Right. So you know, it's a bit of a wild west, right? And like I said, there's well-intentioned teams who might not execute well. There's well-intentioned teams who execute well who don't have good timing. And so it's, you know, it's, as we said, it's early days.
So talk to me a bit about this, about what a Web 3.0 ecosystem would look like. I mean, I think a Web 2.0 ecosystem was more or less defined by physical location. You know, sort of New York has an ecosystem, or sector has a sector has an ecosystem. Which inherently defines participants and agents. What does a Web 3.0 ecosystem look like to you? Who's involved? What are the changing sort of limitations on what the ecosystem is and how it's defined?
Yep. And so this comes back to some of my academic studies, right? So I focused a lot on kind of the psychology and economics of urban planning and trying to predict and shape physical environments of people to behave in a certain way, right? And it's the same mental models and concepts to think about how people would behave in a digital environment, right? So there's a concept called regionalism, right, in urban planning, which is basically markets don't care where one political jurisdiction starts and stops, right? So we've seen, you know, counties and cities give crazy tax breaks trying to get a company to locate there when they're actually all part of the same ecosystem, right? And what's interesting about Web 3.0 is it changes the feasibility on how, you know, communities, you know, markets can function irregardless of political jurisdictions, right? So part of this Uber example, to bring it up again, was Uber saw a delta between demand and need and where regulation was, right? There weren't enough medallions in San Francisco. It was brutal to get a taxi there. It was a joke.
And New York.
Yeah, right? And so they captured the delta, right? And I don't think they should get that full delta, right? And right. So what a Web 3.0 marketplace does is allows people to transact value irregardless of political jurisdiction, right? And so what's interesting in terms of market factors here is not only does the technology play well in our new kind of co-located and, you know, co-workers around the world environment where the world is flat and we have offices all around the world. So it really just embraces that, right? Like, you know, even Web 2.0 startups in San Francisco just in the last month have announced that they're going fully, you know, work from home, right? And so, you know, that trend is happening without Web 3.0, but it's also representative of this technology, right? It allows you to work to do, you know, I think the government of Estonia has a global citizenship offering powered by blockchain today. So anybody can become a citizen of Estonia on the blockchain and open up bank accounts where if you're a consultant traveling the world working for yourself, you now have a very easy way to get paid, right? You can work in Singapore and you can work in London, you can work in Argentina and have just not, you know, paying someone in the middle to make sure that the person's on the hook to pay you what you're due.
To help me understand how this 3.0 technology interfaces with the 2.0 power structure or yeah. ecosystem. I mean, if I want jobs locally and I have some version of regulatory authority and one of your value propositions is to decentralize the workforce or the technology, what's the adoption? What's the ecosystem adoption model here? Is it just inevitability?
It's interesting. It's like, you know, we will go to crypto conferences and we'll go to more traditional fintech conferences. And you see, you know, the CEO of BBVA on stage talking about trust is the most important thing for them, you know, and, you know, paying lip service to crypto. And then you talk to their team at the booth and there's literally no way they can work with you, right? Or there's, you know, there was one company that had the word token in their brand and there wasn't a single Web 3.0 piece of their business, right? And so—
Right, and this is part of the challenge as I see it. And this is why conversations like these matter, right? There's a lot of sort of junk in the system.
The crypto washing, right?
Yes,
it's like,
exactly.
You know, people say it, you know, it's innovation theater for many people, sure. Right? It's, you know, and like I said, the Fortune 500 is still struggling moving to the cloud on the back end and how to leverage the social graph on, you know, the brand and customer side, right? And so, you know, this is a brave new world and there's going to be fits and stops and there's going to be, you know, tremendous impact if a huge company actually powers a new offering with crypto. But there's also a lot of inertia and change management in those companies that'll make it very difficult for them to do that. And government is a great example of this, right? Like, you know, when I work with mayors and governors and, you know, people even at the federal level with 18F and US Digital Service, you know, all of the patterns are the same thing as in corporates. They're just a little bit more exacerbated, right? Bureaucracy and how to coordinate large groups of people towards a goal in an effective and efficient way. Human problem that spans, right. You know, sectors.
Right.
Right. And so that's where I really say, you know, it's going to take, you know, public-private partnership. That's going to take, you know, consensus as a startup working alongside IBM in Dubai.
Right.
Right. Like that was powerful, right? And consensus in the last year has had some growing pains. And, you know, sometimes, you know, holacracy doesn't work. You need leadership, right? Zappos even pulled back from it.
Right.
But to have consensus in IBM toe-to-toe on that project was powerful.
Certainly. And so to talk me through, if you were to design or model out the type of public-private partnership that you think should be fueling 3.0, what would it look like? I mean, who's around the proverbial table? Who needs to be both participating but also part of the adoption curve in order to, you know, drive 3.0 into the lives of everyday
people. So what's interesting is, you know, there's a lot of parallels and kind of extensions of the open source community, right? And so, you know, the BRD wallet, for example, is open source. We have people who fork it and then skin it and compete with us, right? But for us, the more people who are in this space, you know, the tides raise all the boats, right? You know, there's open data movements. Here in New York, we're rare. I think it's the sixth year that open data is a law here. It's not just a policy guideline. By law, every department in the city has to have machine-readable data published on a regular basis, right? That is a really interesting anchor. That data can be used by Uber, and it can also be used by, you know, an accelerator startup.
Right.
Right? And so there's interesting things here around just that open data movement and kind of, you know, and that's where, for me, the governance is fascinating, right? The social psychology of this. If you have a community-powered project, how do you keep people accountable? How do you keep them motivated? How do you keep them marching in the right direction, right? If everybody's got a voice, you know, it's hard to come to the right path forward, right? It's like you have to balance, you know, stakeholder inclusion with, you know, a focused path forward, right?
Right.
And so, you know, that's partly where I kind of talked to the start of the Web 2.0 kind of as a parallel here is, you know, we got to figure out how best to shape this, right? And to actually bring the right voices from government, from underrepresented communities, you know, it's not just the right thing to do. It's actually how you get better solutions.
Right. That's such an important point. The collaboration in its best form is not charitable, right? It's about efficiency. It's about value creation.
Yep.
Talk to me a little bit about the New York City open data and how unique that actually is. This is one of the I think outside of New York City, one of the least understood but most valuable components of the ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean it's fascinating, right? We are all, you know, spitting off data in every action that we take, right? Every car that drives down the street, every raindrop that hits the sidewalk, right? And how do we actually turn that noise into something helpful, actionable? And so, you know, there are interesting things happening, right? So, you know, Sidewalk Labs is an Alphabet subsidiary that's, you know, trying to reimagine cities from the internet up, right? And they're anchored here in Hudson Yards here in New York, which I call the Vatican, right? They've kind of rebuilt an infrastructure within the city, got their own schools, police force, energy grid.
When I was growing up, you should have seen Hudson Yards. I mean, the area that is now Hudson Yards. It's an incredible thing.
Yeah, even in the last 2 years, right? It's unbelievable. You know, Sidewalk Labs has another project in Toronto called Quayside that's actually getting some heat because, you know, they are basically taking control of a huge neighborhood and they're beholden to their shareholders, right? And there's a tension there between what's for the public good and what's for your profit, right? It's amazing, though, the potential, right? So there's this concept called, you know, participatory budgeting that we do here in New York, right? Where citizens can actually vote on how budget is deployed. Imagine if you had a way that you knew that every citizen's voice was counted and couldn't be messed with or tampered with afterwards, right? And you could actually give people a voice. What's also interesting is what if you had not only participatory budgeting, but participatory service delivery? Right, where different people in a neighborhood had different weights for the votes of how they want services deployed that day.
Right.
So if you're a worker in the neighborhood or you're a resident in the neighborhood or you're there as a tourist, right, your voice should probably be weighted differently. Right. And just the feasibility of that type of marketplace, ecosystem, community, neighborhood, whatever you call it, right, the feasibility of balancing more stakeholders is different than it's ever been before. Right. And that's the power is how do we actually, you know, as a community, as a group of people who have an affiliation, you know, chart a course, come together, have consensus on what the plan is, and actually accountability and transparency with the delivery and execution of that plan, right? It's never had the potential to be expressed in a way that it can today, right? But it's up to us because, as I said, technology changes, people don't. There's been, you know, plenty of amazing technology that could have moved humanity and society forward that wasn't deployed to those ends.
Right, right. And on this New York City open data thing, do any examples come to mind how it's been utilized?
Yeah, I mean, there's some cute examples that are also powerful, right? So the New York Department of Parks and Rec has mapped every tree in the five boroughs. So there is a record.
All seven of them.
Yeah. Of all, you know, the type of tree, the height of the tree, the width, right? And that's a blend of, you know, city staffers, satellite images, citizen journalists reporting back on it.
Right.
Right. And so we hosted a hackathon a couple of years ago where people were just figuring out cool things they could do with that. Right. People were making apps to have Jane's walks where you could actually like say types of trees you wanted to see and it would stitch together a little map and you could drive through your neighborhood. Right. Right. Or, you know, people were linking it to.
My daughter would love that.
Yeah, people were linking it to police, right? Because if trees were a certain height and size, they could block sight lines. And so nefarious things might happen behind
right.
them, right? And so, you know, putting that type of data in the hands of people who may have a day job that's completely different, right? You just get interesting, creative solutions, right? And even if those solutions are just something that sparks, you know, an idea in, you know, a you know, someone who works at small business services or someone who works in the government, right? Because they see this cool hackathon proof of concept that is never going to go anywhere itself as a little project, but it provides some new context, some new idea and energy.
It's a function to enable creativity, not to determine application.
Well, and so to come back to kind of the protocol wars, you know, a lot of these protocols have raised lots of money, right, through coin offerings, ICOs. And oftentimes, when it launches, when it goes to production, when the mainnet is live, it turns into a 501c3, right, where it's actually a nonprofit, you know, NGO entity. You know, similarly, you could think of like Mozilla or Firefox, right? Like that is one of the few, you know, earlier examples of an open source project that was successful, right? There's, Linux and a couple of things, right? But that's central to many of the building blocks of Web 3.0, right? Is that it is open source and people can contribute to it and extend it and enhance it and fork it and take it in a different direction, right? And that's encouraged, right? It's, you know, I've worked in open innovation for 15 years using APIs to have 1+1=3 partnerships in business,
right?
Right? Like that's fundamental to this new space, and hopefully it stays that way.
Are there things that you've come across, partnerships or otherwise, that you think about as sort of uniquely exciting towards this this future as you describe it? I mean, the 3.0 feels like it's, you know, really big.
Yeah.
But I think sort of localizing like materially how this comes together is a really powerful thing.
And what's interesting is it's like, what drives new technology, right? In this space, the most straightforward application is financial products and services, right? Just taking some of the friction out of transactions and, you know, connecting people without an intermediary, right? Many things that drive new technologies are, you know, entertainment and media,
right?
Right. So, sure. You know, it will be interesting to see if, you know, there are decentralized, you know, creator platforms where artists can launch, you know, music on Ujo or, you know, digital pieces of art on Props Project, where, you know, there are, you know, blockchain Facebook applications where everyone has more control over their identity and control over the upside of the data that platform creates, mm-hmm. right? You know, some interesting creative applications, there's a project called Ethic Hub, which is basically Kiva for local farming, where people can kind of, without having to pay someone in the middle, you know, contribute to people around the world who are growing local sustainable food. And so, you know, there are those kind of altruistic expressions, which are great. But then there's also, you know, people who I would say are more on the extractive capitalism side of the coin today, who are also going to take advantage of what they can do to potentially, you know, amass more value for their shareholders and stockholders.
Right, right. This is a really interesting and big topic. And I think you said it well. We're at the beginning of a 30-year global shift.
Well, and we're seeing, as we said before, right, we're seeing populist nationalism rise because when people are scared, it's easy to point fingers and scapegoat. right? And so it is going to be very interesting to see how we get out of this, right? Like, you know, there are the powers that be around the world are taking, you know, seats in Senates and Congress and presidencies in a way that we haven't seen since World War II, right? And it's not going to be easy, right? But at the same time, you see, you know, borderless, you know, cosmopolitan, you know, mixed race, mixed thought, cross-disciplinary energy on the rise, right? And it's going to be a wild ride.
It's what a time to be alive, right?
Yeah, I mean,
I don't say that in jest. It's actually just a fascinating,
you know, and for us, you know, we have had an interesting couple of years here in the States, right? Where we thought that potentially we had kind of moved past some of the demons in our past, right? And we haven't. And for me, you know, we hosted a Women in Blockchain event last Monday and provided childcare to be as inclusive as possible. And as I talk about the feasibility changing for a more cooperative expression of capitalism, it's a much more feminine approach, right? It's not top-down military industrial command and control. I have information you don't have. I have lawyers and power that you don't have. I'm going to abuse the power dynamics, right? And it goes into this you know, API cooperative, more ground up expression of capitalism. And it's been going on from before Web 3.0, right? It's like, you know, I've worked in open innovation for a long time, doing partnerships with Yahoo and NASA and bringing together the mayor's office with startups, with, you know, GE. And so it's, you know, it's a trend. I think it's inevitable, but the powers that be could, you know, take their toys and go home if they really want to.
Yeah, right. Which means that we all have to be vigilant. Couple rapid fire questions to close.
All right.
What are you reading these days?
Oh, that is a good question. I have been reading a lot less with two young kids and back to school.
Understandable.
So, you know, I try to limit my news consumption to weekends because, you know, that brings some frustration sometimes that I don't need. You know, in terms of, you know, the crypto world, right? It's like whether it's my Twitter stream or you know, Medium pieces, right? There's a woman named Meltem Demoirs who has wrote a fantastic piece at the end of last spring, which is still top of mind, talking about how this boom reminds her of the shale oil boom when she was an analyst at Goldman, right? And she was seeing basically tons of money pumping into the supply side of a marketplace before demand was validated, right? So there are all these companies who IPO'd, you know, in Appalachia, who 10 years later were penny stocks with nothing there, right? Because oil prices went down and natural gas became more abundant.
Right.
She sees parallels here. We're developing tons of infrastructure that is sometimes redundant, sometimes going to fail. But we're still excited about the space, right? And if we can't hold that tension in our heads, we're fucked.
Yeah. Right. Are you into audiobooks or podcasts?
Or not? Just really? This one?
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for the plug.
So much changing so fast that it's interesting to, you know, review audiobooks, especially in the crypto space from, you know, 2-3 years ago, where there's still some totally prescient, you know, forward thinking, you know, visions that we're still, you know, marching towards. And then there's some things that seem kind of quaint and already out of date.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, that's where I've kind of leaned more into, you know, Medium is the longest form piece that I really read. And, you know, there's, you know, CoinDesk and there's, you know,
sure,
those publications. But it's just moving so fast, right? It's as soon as you finish writing the book, it's kind of out of date.
Yeah, fascinating. Last question: where can listeners find you and BRD online?
Yeah, so we, you know, it's brd.com. My email is peter@brd.com. I'm at Peter Shanley on Twitter. I'm here in New York, so let me know. We've got community events just about every month. You know, if you want to come share your work from the stage. You want to come to the audience, be in touch.
My friend, Peter Shanley. Much appreciated, man.
Thank you, my friend.
That does it for this episode of Super Cities. Before we go, some real talk. Cities feel broken, too expensive, too crowded, too chaotic. So we created Super Cities to elevate the people and trends moving cities forward. This movement is just getting started, so please rate, review, and subscribe to Super Cities and tag us using hashtag Super Cities. Your support really helps, and I'm thankful for it. This is Brendan Hart and Super Cities signing off for now.